This is Jim Fossone from VeteransRadio.net, broadcasting from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. We want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. Also, we'd like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. Until then, let's take it back to Bob Gould right here on Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
On the line with me today, my guest and featured guest today is retired Lieutenant Colonel William Latham. He's a writer, historian, course director of the United States Logistics University at Fort Lee, Virginia. He flew Chinook helicopters in combat during Operation Desert Storm. He wrote a book, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea, and it was published earlier this year. You might want to pick that up, folks, that Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. He and his wife reside in Petersburg, Virginia. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Colonel.
Thank you, Bob.
May I call you Bill?
I'm doing well, Bob. How are you?
Oh, good. But can I call you Bill?
That'd be great.
Great. Bill, where did Korea? Who heard Korea? Where did Korea come from? Was it part of China? Was it part of Japan? How did Korea get formed? What about all that, Bill?
Well, Korea is a peninsula off the connected to northeastern Asia, and it has lived and survived in the shadow of powerful expansionist Chinese emperors to the north for thousands of years and powerful expansionist Japanese emperors to the east for thousands of years. So your description on the website that Korea is a bit like the Belgium of Asia is a pretty good choice of words.
It's stuck. And it's
it is stuck.
Stuck there, and it's like little Jack Horner stuck his thumb in the pie and pulled out a plum. Boy, you could stick your hand in there and get in a lot of trouble in North Korea. It's been and you had Chiang Kai-shek after World War II. I don't think we really liked him, but he was anti-communist. Anything anti-communist after World War II was give them money, give them whatever, no matter how despotic they were. And that was, well, what should tell us about Chiang Kai-shek?
Well, Chiang Kai-shek was essentially a warlord who rose to power and ruled part of China under the Chinese nationalist government. And he was involved in a bitter civil war with Chinese communists led by Mao Zedong, and that civil war was being fought during the 1930s at the same time that the Japanese Empire decided to expand into China. And so the communists and the nationalists declared something of a truce to resist the Japanese invaders with limited success. Both the nationalists and the communists were able to defend portions of the country and keep the Japanese out of there, and the nationalists managed to do that with billions of dollars of U.S. aid helping them. And we did hope that the Chinese nationalists would gain control of the entire country after the war, but once World War II ended, the Civil War resumed. U.S. efforts to broker a ceasefire and some sort of truce with both sides learning to live together did not work. In fact, General George C. Marshall.
The Marshall Plan, yep.
That's right. He was the state Secretary of State for Harry Truman, and he famously went to China and visited with Mao Zedong and came back and let Truman know that There was not much hope in the situation. The communists were not willing to meet our demands, and the nationalists did not really have much of an army to resist. Well, they had a lot of men in their army, but they were not well led, they were not well trained, and the nationalist government under Chiang Kai-shek was inherently corrupt.
Well, apparently,
so there were no friends. We had no friends in that fight.
Well, but why that little country, would China even care about that? Can you maybe touch on that? What would be the purpose of annexing Korea for China? What was going on?
Well, mainly China, Mao Zedong, after seizing power in the fall of 1949 and driving Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists off the Chinese mainland to Taiwan, after he seized power, he did not want to see a pro-U.S. Korean peninsula on his doorstep. So Communist China viewed the North Korean regime north of the 38th parallel is a very important and useful buffer zone. And so that buffer zone was, of course, at great risk when MacArthur led UN forces north of the 38th parallel in the fall of 1950. And although the Chinese warned Truman and MacArthur and the UN leadership that they would respond with force if UN forces went north of the parallel, our leaders ignored those warnings. They thought they were a bluff. And moreover, MacArthur promised Truman that any Chinese incursion would result in a terrible slaughter of the Chinese. As we know, things did not turn out that way at all.
Well, we'll get to that, too, because that is so important, and that's what kept things going for 3 years. But, okay, so we're now in this, and colonial powers were being defeated throughout the world, in Vietnam and the Hucks in the Philippines,
yeah.
And now we're driving out. It looks to me like anything to do with Western influence. So here it is. We've stand down. We've got barely enough, not even a token force in Korea. I don't, as you said, we just didn't take it serious. And then on June the 25th, at around 5 o'clock in the morning, what happened? 1950.
Well, all hell broke loose. To put it mildly, the North Koreans attacked with 7 divisions, following a plan written by their Soviet advisors, and rolled across the border and steamrolled the South Korean army, a significant portion of which was not on duty that day. A portion of the South Korean army was fighting communist guerrillas in the south, and other portions were on weekend leave for the not for the harvest, but for the anyway, they were the South Korean lines along the DMZ were not well manned, and the North Korean army went through that defensive perimeter rather quickly and easily, thanks to all of the tanks that they had been provided by the Soviets.
By the Russians.
They captured the South Korean capital, Seoul, within 4 days, and thought that might achieve a quick coup d'etat, so to speak, but
to their displeasure,
the regime of Syngman Rhee did not surrender when the capital fell. Rather, he and his government fled south at the same time that Harry Truman decided to commit U.S. forces and later U.N. forces to defend the Korean Peninsula against what was obviously a North Korean invasion.
So It was an invasion. Now we've got this tinderbox. It's like stepping on the trip plunger of a landmine, and you can't take your foot off, because if you do, the whole thing's going to blow up. And here they are, the Americans. It was then given to the State Department on June 25th. And who was the Secretary of Defense then? Was that
Secretary of Defense was Lewis Johnson. The Secretary of State was Dean Acheson.
Dean Acheson, okay. And our president, of course, was Harry Truman.
President was Harry Truman. Acheson had famously given a speech in Washington in January of 1950, announcing or defining the American sphere of influence in the Pacific, and he drew a line, and the Korean Peninsula was clearly outside the line of defense that he had that he defined, which included Japan and the Philippine Islands, for example. And critics have in the past pointed to that speech as an unforgivable sin that sent the wrong message and invited communist aggression. But that's a bit of a myth. In fact, U.S. policy had dismissed the idea of defending Korea against a communist invasion for well over a year. MacArthur was aware of that. The chiefs of staff were aware of it. Acheson and the Secretary of Defense were aware of it. But when the North Koreans did actually invade, assuming that the U.S. would not respond, Truman felt obliged to do something.
And he didn't.
I think the fact that we had not been able to do anything about the communist seizure of power in China certainly influenced that decision by Truman.
And Truman did not go to the UN first when he started sending troops. Is that correct?
Well, he initially ordered MacArthur to send military aid and to provide air cover for the evacuation of U.S. citizens. But his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, did move very quickly to line up UN support, and that included a resolution passed by the UN in the Security Council to commit forces to defend South Korea. And they were able to get that resolution only because the Soviet Union was at the time boycotting the Security Council.
Okay, so it's June 25, shots ring out, here it is, it's starting, and what were the Americans, what in the world were they thinking about what's going on here? Is this an exercise? Is this a training? Is what is this? And how soon and close could they get rescuers to come from? I think they came from Hawaii. So why don't you cover those two parts?
I'll be glad to. We had about 450 advisors on the ground in Korea with the South Korean Army. And most of those advisors were pretty quick to realize that this was a major North Korean invasion. Unfortunately, the South Korean troops were poorly equipped and not very well trained. They were tough as nails, but they weren't very well equipped. They weren't very well trained, and they did not fare well during the first week of fighting, and that was the main reason that the South Korean capital fell so quickly in 4 days. But Truman... MacArthur, with Truman's permission, began sending aircraft to attack North Korean columns that very first week of the war, and that helped a little bit. And then the Truman administration agreed, after MacArthur famously visited the battlefield that first week, he came back and notified the Joint Chiefs, and he notified the White House that the only way to stop the North Koreans would be through the use of American ground forces. And at that point, Truman gave MacArthur permission to send ground forces from Japan. We had four divisions on the ground in Japan as part of the post-war occupation force. They had been on occupation duty for most of that time and had just started training for combat missions within the year prior to the beginning of the Korean War. They too were poorly equipped. Most units were at two-thirds strength, two-thirds of their troops, two-thirds of their equipment, two-thirds of their supporting artillery, almost no tanks, and very few combat aircraft.
And we were pretty much throwing spitballs at those T-34s. I mean, with the lack of real equipment, again, it was a stand-down time with this country. Tell us a little bit about, we've only got about 3 minutes before the break, halfway, so tell us a little bit about the equipment as far as weaponry that we had at that time, including something to challenge the M-15s, and we'll get
well,
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the American Armed Forces that fought in Korea initially fought with World War II equipment, much of it out of date, much of it in poor condition, and the American forces in Japan were so poorly equipped, partly because the American public was in a rush to dismantle the enormous military structure that we had created while winning World War II. There was also some thinking that nuclear weapons and our monopoly on nuclear weapons, which we had until 1949, would serve as a cheap deterrent to Soviet aggression. And then Mr. Truman's Secretary of Defense, Lewis Johnson, was a notorious cost cutter and did not make matters better. Moreover, the Truman administration was under pressure from Republicans in Congress to reduce defense spending. So all of these things combined together to create what we refer to as a hollow force. We had a lot of men in uniform, but they were not very well equipped, and they really were not well organized to fight a large-scale conventional war like the one that broke out in Korea.
And we're being pushed back as more troops were getting pushed south. The South Korean Army, the American Marines are being pushed all the way into Pusan. We've got about 2 minutes. Tell us about the Pusan perimeter.
Well, the Pusan perimeter was formed after 4 weeks of fighting. American and Korean forces dug in along the river formations north and to the west of the port city of Pusan. And that area is a relatively small area in the southeast corner of South Korea. And it was in these mountains and hills where American and South Korean forces made their last stand and dug in.
And that was it. That was it. We were not going to retreat. We were not going to pull out, correct?
That is correct. And we started to, we stopped giving up ground around the last week of July, the first week of August. And the North Korean invaders made a terrible mistake. They sent a column off to the right, to the south, to outflank American and Korean forces defending along Highway 1, which bisects the Korean Peninsula from Seoul down to Busan. And it was along that highway that most of the big battles were fought during the month of July. The North Koreans had wisely sent a flanking unit around the American left flank, which was completely undefended, but that division dawdled and got down to the southern tip of Korea too slowly, giving the Americans time to react.
Okay, we're coming. Yeah, okay, all the Marines heard that one. That's, that was Semper Fidelis? No, that couldn't be. It was our guide. But anyway, it came from the Marines album. CD, no, DVD, whatever they are. We've got the Marine thing. And we're talking right now with Lieutenant Colonel retired William Latham of the West Point and Army Logistics Center. And, okay, it's now we've regrouped, resupplied, restocked down in Pusan. We're down in the southeastern corner of South Korea. And we're going to be doing something. Something's up because I'm not a big fan of MacArthur. I thought he was a big pompous baboon. But anyway, he had a brilliant plan. Tell us about that.
Well, Bob, MacArthur, from the very first week of the Korean War, envisioned an amphibious assault that would outflank the North Korean invaders and cut off their logistics from the rear. At first, he planned to use the 1st Cavalry Division in that operation, but quickly realized that the North Koreans were advancing too quickly and that he needed the 1st Cavalry to defend the Pusan perimeter. So then he persuaded the Marine Corps to endorse his idea. This also got the Marine Corps into the war. The Marine Corps Commander General Lem Shepard was the senior Marine that MacArthur approached about this idea, and MacArthur directed his staff long before the Pentagon approved the idea to begin planning for a major amphibious assault that would outflank the Koreans. They looked at several locations, and they decided on Incheon, which was perhaps the worst place in the world to conduct an amphibious assault, but it was also a place that was undefended or virtually undefended by the North Koreans. And so even though within a couple weeks prior to the assault, the Chinese and the Soviets both warned the North Koreans of the possibility of an American landing there, the North Koreans did not respond effectively. They did not put mines in the water. They didn't mine the harbor, and therefore the American and South Korean invasion fleet landed in mid-September almost unopposed and were able to seize the port, and within a week, Marine and Army units were fighting their way into the city of Seoul. That completely changed the tenor of the Korean War.
They cross the 38th parallel. They're moving north, and MacArthur was even thinking of using nuclear warheads, and he was feeling his Cheerios. He must have been, his chest was pumped out. He just had the successful landing. They're moving north. They're heading. It's getting into October, November. Here we are, Thanksgiving. Take us back to them.
Well, MacArthur was so confident that at the Wake Island conference with President Truman, he discussed the possibility of transferring one or more Army divisions from Korea to Germany by Christmas. And he assured Truman that any Chinese incursion would result in MacArthur's term, the greatest slaughter. Unfortunately, that's not how it worked out. MacArthur did one smart thing and one stupid thing during that month. The smart thing he did was wait for a UN mandate before he sent UN forces north of the 38th. And that was important because MacArthur was aware that he had a negative image among the Allies and that they saw him as a rogue commander. So it was a smart move on his part to wait until he got that mandate. But the foolish thing he did was he really tried to repeat his success at Incheon a second time, and he reloaded the 1st Marine Division back onto landing craft and along with the 2nd Infantry Division, and they sailed all the way around the Korean Peninsula to the east side of North Korea to conduct amphibious landings at the port of Hamnung and Wonsan. Unfortunately for MacArthur, the North Koreans this time had mined the harbors, and the Marines and your other two guests probably remember this, had to sail around in circles for a week waiting for ships to clear the mines from the harbor. Meanwhile, both the 8th Army under General Walker and Korean forces on the East Coast were progressing almost unopposed towards the Yalu River. And as early November turned to mid-November, it really looked like the war was all but over. In fact, Time magazine published a cover story on how we won the war, and that story was published in the first week of November. Of course, we hadn't won the war. We thought we would rush to the Yalu, mop up the North Koreans, and hand over a reunified Korea to the South Korean government for a transition to a democratic country. That's what we thought. The Chinese had other ideas. They snuck several hundred thousand men into North Korea under cover of darkness and hiding in the mountains, unobserved by American aircraft. And in late November, the Chinese sprang a massive counterattack, which drove back the 8th Army on the west side of Korea and encircled the 1st Marine Division at the Chosin Reservoir.
Tell us about that, Bill.
The reservoir was not really a strategic asset. When the Marines got to the plateau on which the Chosin Reservoir sits, about 70 miles north of Wonsan, the temperatures dropped about 40 degrees in a single day, and the 1st Regiment there, I believe, was the 7th Regiment under Litzenberg, encountered over 200 cold weather injuries on the first day that the temperatures plunged. Fortunately, the Marines were better equipped for the cold weather than the Chinese, many of whom were wearing tennis shoes. And in fact, in the later battles, cold weather injuries put more Chinese out of action than Marine gunfire, although that was pretty formidable. But MacArthur had and his subordinate, Ned Allman, had completely underestimated Chinese resistance, and they planned to push all of their forces north on separate lines of advance that could not support each other north to the Yalu. And there really was just this headlong rush to the Yalu initially. There's a mountain range in between the Chosin Reservoir and the forces on the East Coast, and then General Walker's 8th Army on the West Coast. And when the Chinese ambushed Walker's 8th Army on the West Coast, MacArthur changed the orders for the Marines and directed them to push due west into the mountains. It was an insane idea. And fortunately, the Marines did not get too far into those mountains before the Chinese attacked. If the Chinese had attacked, if the Chinese had let the Marines go another couple of miles to the west down those mountain trails, this is the 5th and 7th Regiment at Chosin, they could have easily cut off the 5th and 7th Regiments from the main base at the Chosin Reservoir, and it would have been might have been a different story. But fortunately, the Chinese did not let the Marines advance too far to the west, and the entire perimeter at the Chosin Reservoir came under Chinese attack. And after defeating those attacks, General Smith and the 1st Marine Division and what was left of the Army's 31st Regiment were able to fight their way back down the trail they'd come up, while the 1st Regiment under Colonel Puller held a defensive perimeter at Kodo Ree, and that was really a critical defensive spot because that was the back door for the rest of the Marines to get back down out of the mountains.
Colonel?
Smith was credited with saying that, but that was actually not Smith's style. Some reporter asked Smith a question about that at the reservoir, and Smith gave an answer, and the reporter said something like, "Do you mean you're attacking in another direction?" And Smith said, "Yes, that's what I meant." So basically, some reporter put those words in Smith's mouth, but it's a great line, and it really is. It does accurately capture what happened. The Marines did fight their way out of the Chosin Reservoir down a long, narrow mountain road, and the entire 1st Marine Division was strung out in a long column. The infantry had to dismount and conduct fighting patrols on the ridge lines to deter and defeat Chinese snipers and Chinese ambushes. And it was a long, hard fight getting down off of that mountain. Bob, one of the other things General Smith did that was very smart was that he insisted on building an airfield at the Chosin Reservoir. And
that's
because
right.
He built that airfield, the Marines were able to fly out hundreds of casualties, which made it a lot easier for them to fight their way down that mountain road, and they were able to fly in supplies and reinforcements.
But thank you very much, Bill Latham. I didn't get a chance to talk about your latest thing at Kuwait when you're let's get that music up. Yeah, when you're doing logistics training, I wanted to talk about that. We'll get to that at another point. And remember, folks, to go out, you want to have something of cold days in hell, American POWs in Korea, cold days in hell, and it's available from Texas A&M University Press. Bill,
thanks,
Bill,
Fred.
Will you come back and finish the story or keep going with the story? Will you come back?
Of course, Bob.
I'm knowing
thanks
you.
Thanks very much for having me as a guest.
And thank you again. He's a many-time guest on our program.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. 4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.